From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Eric Logan, filling in for Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last week, or a couple of weeks ago, has it only been a couple of weeks, when Vice President Kamala Harris named Governor Tim Walz as her running mate. As Harris introduced Walz to the public for the first time at a rally in Philadelphia, she ran through his titles, governor, husband, and dad. He was representative, sergeant major, and Mr. Walz. That's what his students called him back when he was a social studies teacher, and to his former high school football players, Harris said. Building towards the playoff, the payoff there, he was coach. And she flashed her biggest smile. Coach, she repeated. Coach! Walz pumped his fist. The crowd cheered and chanted as Walz beamed. The New Yorker magazine wrote, Harris could have chosen the Arizona Senator Mark Kelly as her running mate, an astronaut. Instead, she chose the high school football coach, a molder of men, the high priest of the American state religion. The only thing missing was the marching band. Both major political parties have been looking for more coaches who want to run for office. This week, the Democratic National Convention, one of the most popular signs says, Kamala and the coach. Basketball coaches Greg Popovich and Steve Kerr have been courted to run for office, and Tim Walz often leads with his coaching experience. So why do we value coaches in office? What can we learn? What is the importance and impact of coach in the American culture and politics? How have coaches affected you over the years? Or if you served as a coach, how has that changed you? Joining me at the Connection Desk today to discuss these questions is John Baines, Monroe County Legislator for District 11. He's a retired teacher who taught for over 40 years and serves on the legislature's Recreation and Education Committee, as well as on the Planning and Economic Development Committee as the ranking minority member. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It is good to have you here. And Tom Proietti. You've been here before. You know all about
Way
connections.
Too many times.
Yeah, media reporter for WXXI and resident media scholar at St. John Fisher. And he also has served as a coach. Welcome.
Yes, I have, Eric. Thank you. Great to be here.
So I'm going to start, John, with you. Tell us about your experience either as a coach or on the receiving end. And what is it about being a coach?
Well, my father was a prominent coach in Rochester. He's in four or five halls of fame. I'm not in any, I would point out. I have the same name. I'm one of his 10 children. And I'm from East Rochester, which has a tradition of great coaches. So I thought that I might be a coach, and I did actually coach basketball at Aquinas and at East Rochester. I coached football at Aquinas. I coached track at Fairport High. But I was probably the worst coach in Monroe County history. Hmm. And my coaching career has been as a coach of student writers. And for 46 years, I taught 11th and 12th grade English. And I do some consulting with student writers. So my interest in coaching is kind of by exposure to great coaches. If in the Fairport schools, we also have so many legendary coaches that I represented as president of their union and negotiated their contracts. So that's kind of my coaching story or my exposure to it. And as we unpack the idea of coaching, I think we're going to see that in the modern workplace, in the modern world, that coaching is central to the development of human potential.
Excellent. I totally agree with you on that.
Well said, John.
Yeah, real well said. Tom, same question.
Yeah, Eric, I've always been in awe of coaches, partially because I went to Franklin High School. I graduated in 1963, and my coach there terrified me. His name was Mauro Panaggio. He had a great reputation as being a great coach. Later on in life, I realized he had his approach. And it was not my approach. His approach was he never once called me by my name. The only player he ever called by their name in history was a great local athlete named Trenton Jackson. And he called him TJ. But everybody else was, we were called by our numbers. And winning was everything. And he once, I think he wanted to eject me from the team because I had just pitched one of the best games of my life. So he also coached baseball, football, and basketball. And we were coming back from Charlotte High School, and I pitched against a guy who did a great broadcast career named Lanny Frattari, ended up being the voice of the Pittsburgh Pirates for many years. Lanny's probably listening today, too. But I pitched a perfect game for 7 innings. But we were tied 0-0. We went into the 8th inning, and I walked the first batter. And this was against Charlotte, and I walked the first batter, and then the next pitch, the batter swung and missed. The runner on first base ran to second base, and the catcher threw the ball into center field, and the ball continued to roll because it was Franklin High School. We had no fences. And it ran. The runner came all the way around, scored, and we lost 1-0. So I lost a perfect game, 1-0, by walking one. Actually, I think I hit the batter. I didn't walk him. But in the bus on the way back, we were at Charlotte. We were on the bus on the way back. I remember sitting there. Nobody wanted to be near me either. I think they all felt so bad for the guy that lost the perfect game. But I started smiling, kind of had a smirk on my face too, because I kept thinking, what if I had to write the headline for this? What would I say? And the coach Panaggio came over to me and he said, "There's nothing funny about losing." And I will never forget that the rest of my life, because I think he missed the point to coaching. And I don't think he ever really had a great time. I coached a lot of other things. I coached Little League. I coached softball. I was an assistant football coach at St. John Fisher. I coached the women's basketball team for 1 year at St. John Fisher. And by the way, that should be a series. And not like Ted Lasso. It would be something completely different. But winning was never that important to me. And I grew up in that age when Vince Lombardi said, winning is the only thing. And my dad was a guy who, he rooted for everything Cleveland. And if you know the record of Cleveland, they never won very much.
Right.
And I used to ask him, I mean, he died in 1988, and I said, how come you were such a Cleveland fan and you stayed such a Cleveland fan? Because they never won. And he said, and that's the test of loyalty. And he said, is that you stuck with them through thick and thin? And he did. And I think loyalty is one of those great things as a coach that I tried to engender. And I called everyone by their name. I despised right. being called number 17.
So we're going to talk a little bit more later about the importance of coaching and helping people learn how to lose as opposed to only being a coach for winners. But before we go there, before we talk about the personal development, one of the reasons why this topic is in the public eye right now is because it has hit the political stage.
Yes.
Right? And it's right there out front. When you hear the word coach, is there anything inherently partisan about that?
You know, I watched live her introduction of him, and she relished the opportunity to call him coach.
Yeah.
And I think that we have to unpack that moment with an understanding that the vice president understands the vice presidency. She understands that when you are vice president, you are at the game, but you are not in the game, and that you are a critical advisor. And I think that I think she was using the word coach so repetitively because it aligns with Tim Walz's biography, but it also, he was never the head coach, by the way. I'm kind of going to get particular and unpack that moment.
Yes.
He was, the head coach was the Lombardi guy. The head coach at the school was the Bobby Knight, you know?
But it was Walt, though, that everybody went to when they had a problem.
Right
on. They didn't want to go to the Lombardi guy.
Right on. He was the uplifter. He was the guy who knew their names for sure. Didn't see them.
he wasn't number 17. Right.
So I think that Kamala Harris understood in a really kind of really in her bones, you know, that this guy ticks all kinds of boxes, that he understands the role of the vice presidency. You know, he's married to a powerful woman who turns out was the star English teacher, and whereas he was the kind of cheerful social studies teacher. So I think he his bona fides as a kind of supporter of the on-field talent and an uplifter, and his understanding of the role that he's not going to be the head coach, all of that factors into how, you know, brilliant this decision was on her part.
Tom?
John, you just nailed that. I kept thinking about how much time I spent on benches as a player and as a coach. And so many times I spent so much time there, but John just said that so perfectly because the vice president knows that they're a vice president. They're in the room, but they're not necessarily in the game. And I spent so much time as a player on the bench and so many missed opportunities for what we later on in life as a college professor, I learned there was such a thing as the teachable moment. And, you know, I sat there, you know, not knowing, probably daydreaming and not being, you know, just not being involved in the game. And this was especially true in high school until my senior year. My senior year, I had a coach named Jack Christensen, who was just the opposite of Mauro Panaggio. Jack Christensen loved us. He hugged us. He used to tell us that we, no matter where you were such an important part of the game. And on the bench, he would make sure that we sat around him, and he was always patting our backs and telling us that, you know, you're going to get your shot. You're going to get your shot. In fact, he sent me once up as a pinch hitter, and I was a terrible hitter, and he sent me up as a pinch hitter. Now, we were ahead 11-2 or something like that, but it just made me feel so good because he knew what was going on in my heart and in my mind. And for Jack Christensen, we went from being, you know, under Mauro Panaggio, we were virtually an undefeated in basketball, baseball, and football. Jack Christensen, I played on the first team that was the 500 team in my life, and I had more fun than I ever could imagine. So,
you know, I've got a story about Jack, but...
Jack Christensen?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, what a gem.
He was a good friend of my father's.
Yes, he was.
But... You know, I also think back to the political moment that the word most associated with coach, and if you know they have those word maps, right, where they got a word in the middle, and then the word most associated with it is team. Mm-hmm. And another thing I think that the vice president has done is she's tried to her rhetorical skills have impressed me immensely. Rhetoric, when it's effective, is intentional, and you understand your audience and you understand what you're trying to rebut, you know, the other side of the argument. And I think that she moved to the pronoun we. So she kind of went from coach and then kind of moves to the concept of team, and then it's we. And I think that, is she trolling the former president? She probably is. But there's a distinction there with we and I alone can fix it. I mean, that wasn't a statement that former President Trump made off the cuff. He made the statement, I alone can fix it, in his inaugural address. So, and by the way, my Jack Christensen story, he coached Franklin, and they won the Section 5 championship of basketball in 1970, and they graduated everybody.
Yes.
So the next year, my team, you know, I was on a good team, and we get to the semifinals at the War Memorial, and we play Franklin, and Jack Christensen's got basically his reserves, his JV kids, and they beat us in that game, and my father just loved him, and he came over to see us. My father didn't always love the other coaches, I can tell you that, and they didn't always love him. In fact, I think they rarely did, but he came over to see us, Jack Christensen, in the locker room, and it still is the most crushing moment of my life, right?
That, but just, you know, think you remember that he came to see
us. He came to see us.
That was Jack.
And so I think when we talk about coaches, it's also kind of back to your story, Tom. It's kind of like cholesterol. They kind of come in good and bad forms, right? and I think that when we're talking about a coach in the modern idiom, we're not talking about a bully. We're not talking about win at all costs. It's more like the modern workplace that's collaborative. So it's interesting that Steve Kerr last night spoke at the convention, and Steve Kerr was our Olympic coach, and he's the coach of the Golden State Warriors. And, you know, his relationship with his players, he's a former player, is collaborative. He's the coach, but he doesn't have the distance between himself and the players. And I think that he values them as fellow leaders, right? And so he uplifts them. And I think your story about how he believed in you, I think that one of the critical, maybe the most important thing that a great coach does is a great coach believes in her or his mentees.
Yes. Yeah, you know, Jack would walk up and down the, you know, again, I spent time on the bench, so even when I was playing, I was a little bit of a star because I was a good pitcher. So pitchers don't play. Yeah, they miss probably 3 out of 5 games. So he would come along and he would, you know, this bench time can be brutal for a player, and he would just tap us on the shoulder and all good, and that was Jack. And under other coaches I had, I never had that feeling that I really was there 100%. I was there more like 60% if I wasn't in the game and I was sitting on the bench. Now, the other thing I did is I coached and I umpired baseball for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And so I had a great chance to watch different kinds of coaches. I've got many arguments with coaches. I'll never forget one coach at Genesee Valley Park in a Little League game. He comes out to me right before we didn't do lineup cards at Little League. We did come out to kind of explain ground rules, and he said to me and the other coach, he said, I have some people some of the parents are really, really nasty folks. He said, so before they get too nasty, he said, I'll come out and talk to you. And he did. He came out and talked to me. He said, he would look at my face and he'd say, let's make it look like we're arguing. He said, because that's the way I can diffuse them. Mm. And we were having a great conversation. Yeah. He was talking about weather and talking about, I have a son named Aaron after Hank, and everybody knew that I had just had this child who was named after Hank Aaron, and they were, they would say, let's talk about your son's name. But watching coaches on both sides, how they treated people, and also one of the things that I really found hurtful, something fixable, was especially amongst Little League coaching, was that so many of the coaches were parents who were never once trained for one moment to be a coach of any sort.
So evident on the sidelines.
Yeah, they were in loco parentis. They weren't in loco coach.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing I have to say one other thing about coach, though, because I didn't know I was going to be on today until a little while ago. Yesterday, I watched about 5 episodes of Cheers. And if you remember Ernie, the original coach on Cheers, he was kind of the stereotype of many coaches. Mm-hmm. He was not very bright. He was not very practical. And he was kind of like what we used to say about some teachers,
Well, the best coaches are bright. They have to be in order to do what they do.
Absolutely.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to 1370 Connections. I'm Eric Logan filling in for Evan Dawson. And we're talking about the importance of coach in American culture and politics. And I have the wonderful benefit of having in the room with me John Baines, Monroe County legislator for District 11, who is chatting with me about his experiences and his insights into the political world as well. And Tom Proietti, media reporter for WXXI and resident media scholar at St. John Fisher University, and who has also served as coach. And what I forgot to do earlier was to invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation as well. You can join the conversation at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. That's toll free. If you're here in the Rochester area, 585-263-9994. Or you can email us at connections@wxxi.org. A moment ago, we talked about how coach was not only sports, but also you see that evident in the business world as well. You want to talk a little bit about that? What does that look like? And what are the similarities between coaching, although I think they use a different word, at least in my case, we use the word mentor. But what is the difference in the business world as opposed to sports?
Well, I think that the key to one of the things about America and about American schooling, which is my life, is that we're performance oriented. We value, in fact, high stakes performance. We don't like it having a kid take a test and not do well, and that might affect his self-esteem. But we'll put him out there at the bottom of the ninth in front of everybody, and he'll strike out. And so, whether it's the school theater program, whether it's the school music program, when it comes to translating potential into performance, that's where the rubber hits the road. That's kind of at the core of the American ethos. We value performance. That's why they say let's do it, not let's study it. You know, I mean, that isn't the mantra of, I don't think, of any athletic company. So, you know, one of the things about the modern kind of workplace and personal development aspects of America is that everybody is understanding that I have to get the most out of my ability. And how do I get the most out of my ability? Well, one way is to have a champion. So we have personal trainers, for instance, who help us with our fitness, or we have people interacting, you know, seeking medical professionals, whether they're for their physical or mental well-being. And in all these instances, I think we've come to understand that it's okay to be open to coaching.
Yes.
And that that perspective of another person who has us in mind and our ability in mind and puts us first is not something necessarily that we felt, you know, I was one of 10 kids and lost in the shuffle and all that stuff. Well, nobody cares about that. That was a long time ago. Now we, you know, I'm looking for a champion. And I think, so a coach in the modern idiom is a champion, somebody who is trying to make me perform better. And if I'm coaching, my entire job is to meet the needs of my client. So I coach student writers. And everything has to be about their voice and maximizing their effectiveness. And I think that when you've experienced good coaching, it's you recognize that it's of great value to you. So you seek it.
Yeah, yeah, so true.
One of the things I did in teaching was I heard very early on in my college teaching career at St. John Fisher that one of my colleagues who I really valued as a great teacher said to me, he said, always understand, as long as you're teaching in a college, especially undergraduates, that it's an incubator. And he said, as an incubator, he said, we give them a second chance and sometimes a third chance. So for years, I would assign, first off, I very rarely gave tests. I did, in my field of media, testing didn't really prove to be all that valuable. Projects were much better, and they were much better to be become part of a portfolio. And they were the kind of a replica or a, you know, a training ground for what they were going to face in the real world. You know, if you're going to work in a newsroom or in an ad agency or a director of public relations, you're going to do a lot more preparation work. You do a lot more project kind of work. And if they kind of blew it on the first effort, I wouldn't even give them a grade, or I'd give them an incomplete and say, you know, you have some really good ideas in here. Why don't you take it back and start over again, or take the best parts of the idea, and maybe you just needed a little bit more time. And you know, some people used to say, well, you're just kind of feeding the procrastinators by doing that. I found out if you built a trusting relationship, there were no procrastinators. Mm. You know, you just – and one thing I heard from John Wooden over and over again was he used to say over and over, as I did – I borrowed this from the great John Wooden. If there was nothing else I could teach you, you can't be late. You just can't be late. Right, and, you know, Bill Walton just passed away. I don't know if you know, anybody knows this story about Bill Walton, but first time they went on a road trip, they went to the airport. They didn't go together. They were supposed to meet at the airport. And Walton shows up in a pair of jeans, and he's violating. You know, he's in jeans, and he didn't have a sport coat on. He didn't have a tie on. This is the 1960s, or early 70s. And John Walton just didn't – John Wooten what was his name, John?
Wooden.
John Wooden didn't tolerate that. And he sent him back home. He sent back the best player, sent him back home. He said, we won by 3 points. And he said, when I saw him the next day, I said, see, we can win without you. And you have to show up on time.
You know, you're really getting at one of the trickiest aspects of coaching, which is the relationship between support and truth.
Oh, say more.
I think coaches try to be, they have to be truthful. Because again, we're dealing with performance. So let's say, Eric, you're riding the bench and you say, you know, why is Tom playing and why am I not playing? And the coach has to keep you in the fold, encourage you to get better, but at the same time, be truthful about your ability and your performance. And I think the best coaches and the best teachers can give the bad news and make a person feel good.
Right.
You know, the bad coaching is when you give them good news and you make them feel bad. So, you know, the and by the way, teaching and coaching, we're talking about them, they are the same. I think there's a slight difference culturally in the way we perceive coaches, though. from the way we perceive teachers. We can unpack that. But, you know, I always told my teachers at Fairport that I represented, I said, look, when you get to the highest level of teaching, you're coaching. And one of the things that we did in Fairport, which I think was really important, and we had Don Santini, who was our great football coach, and Jeff Fitch, who was our basketball coach, and Gary Clark, who was our swim coach. And they came to me and some other people and said, we're going to treat coaching like a profession. It's not an avocation. It's not something you can just get a whistle and do. It's an extremely high-skill occupation and profession. And I think that attitude back in the 60s and 70s has continued to improve the coaching ranks. And so, we see better coaching all the time.
Yeah. So part of what this discussion has made me remember, and actually I hadn't thought about it until we got into this conversation. Before I go there, I want to invite our listeners, if you want to be a part of the conversation, please go ahead and call 844-295-8255 or 585-263-9994 if you're local, or you can write us at connections at WXXI.org. Over 10 years ago, when I applied for the job of infrastructure manager for the city of Rochester, a job that I held for many years, and I loved it, and a lot of it was around coaching. The CIO at the time, who was interviewing me for this role that was going to work under him, directly under him, you could see all on his walls, he was a hockey coach, a hockey fan, and hockey coaching was in his blood, and he talked about it all the time. He talked about going to the corners and making sure that you really do execute well. But it was interesting that during that interview at one point, he said to me, he says, so how are you going to make this team better? He says, his perspective, his perception of the team that I was to take over was that they weren't very good. And please, I hope nobody listening here feels that way,
take
right?
That one home,
because
right?
the truth of the matter was, it was a team of great folks. However, the thing I had learned, and this is what I shared with him, I said, you know, it's all about what I've learned to be situational leadership.
Right.
And he looked at me kind of like, well, what do you mean by that? And I said, you don't take your entry level middle school student and coach them the same way that you would coach a pro. I said, you know, in Little League, you might actually go up and help that kid approach the base, show him how to hold the bat, pull up on his elbow, or any of those things that are necessary. I said, if you do that with Derek Jeter, you're going to be eating the bat. Right? I said, so there's that wide range. And by the time you get to Derek Jeter, you know, as a coach, you're going to step back and say, do you see what's going wrong there? And Derek's going to either say, no, I don't see it. And then you bring your coaching in while I'm watching the pitcher and he's dropping it low to the right all the time and you're not getting it or whatever it is, right, that the person happens to be missing. Or the guy says, I think I got it, coach. I just got to work on that. And you back off, right? Give him the space. That's because of the difference. Well, what I had discovered over my years and applied at the city was that teams are exactly the same way. You can have a team of people who are pros, really good at what they do, but haven't learned how to work together. So you have to guide them through that growth period of apprentice and journeyman and expert in the same way that you would an individual taking them there. And so the whole idea of coaching is very much a part of performance management, right, if indeed you're doing it in a way for the benefit of others.
Right. That's well said.
That's the art, yeah. You know. And, you know, the old cliche, this or the axiom, I wouldn't call it a cliche, is I treat everybody equitably by treating them differently. Mm. And that's what your anecdote reflects, that if we're going to unlock the potential of everyone, we have to truly know, see, and celebrate and understand everyone as an individual.
Right. So right. So
that's
right.
That's beautifully said. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell you what, we're going to take our only break of the hour. And when we come back, we're going to, once again, if you'd like to call, 454-6, no, this is the wrong number. That's the fundraising number.
We'll take your money.
I know that number, 454-6300, but that's not the number today. Today it is 585-263-9994. You can write us at connections.org and be a part of the conversation. But when we come back, and we'll give folks a chance to think about it, what is the impact when a coach violates our trust? We have seen so much of that in the Olympics lately and coming to the forefront. I don't mean there have been a lot of coaches doing it, but when a coach does it, the impact of it. Let's take our only break of the hour and come back and talk about that.
Coming up in our second hour, my colleague Eric Logan hosts the program talking about scams. Scams that target typically older people, but not always. Scams that might ask you to give a small amount of money and a credit card number, or might tell you that they're sending you medical devices that you didn't ask for, or all kinds of other scams. And we're going to learn about how to deal with them next hour.
So we're back. This is Connections. I'm Eric Logan, sitting in for Evan Dawson. We're talking about the importance and the impact of coach in American culture and politics with our guests, Monroe County Legislator John Baines and Tom Proietti, media consultant and media scholar at St. John Fisher University. And, of course, you, when you call in at 844-295-8255 or 585-263-9994, you can write us at connections.org. Now, we do actually have a couple of comments via email. If you don't mind, before we go to that question about when a coach violates our trust, here's an email from Suzanne in Rochester, and who says, "Although I think Walt was a fine choice, my Minnesota relatives really like him, and he brings a lot to the table. I believe that highlighting his status as coach is meant to be reassuring for those who are freaking out about a woman being at the head of the ticket. Associating her campaign with football, specifically men's football, softens the veneer of feminism for those who associate the word with anti-male sentiments. If he had been a girl soccer coach, diving coach, or the chess team coach, I don't think they'd be highlighting that part of his CV as much." And I have a couple of more listener comments before we go there. Derek says, this looks like a gender issue without explicitly saying it's a gender issue. What female coaches do we know in government? To this Republican, the candidacy of Tim Walz looks like they want to balance having a woman on the ticket with a kind of man's man, a hunter, a coach. Maybe I'm reading too much gender into the coaching part of it. And then Amy says, "Why should we assume that a coach is likely to be a good elected leader? One thing that drives me crazy is that when someone succeeds in one aspect of life, and therefore they therefore assume that they'll be excellent in Washington. We see this in business all the time. Witness the Starbucks CEO who decided to run for president, even though he had never been elected to anything as high as a dog catcher. Isn't it dangerous to assume that a good coach would be a good senator or a good vice president? Do you want to comment on any of those items before we move forward?"
Well, I do think that strategy was involved.
This is coming from the legislator.
I mean, I do think that Kamala Harris understands the vocabulary and the infrastructure of American people and their psychology, and how much change they are willing to jump toward. And, I think that she and Tim Walz are both Democrats. They share the same values. I would agree with our Republican friend that indeed she probably did consider that he is from a small town in Nebraska, that he worked on a farm, that, you know, narrative is there's nothing more powerful than narrative. And you can't sell rhetoric without being tethered to the truth. It's hollow and it's exposed. So this business of her calling him coach is, you know, that's not the big issue here. The big issue here is does Tim Walz bring an experience, a life experience, and an understanding of the dreams and hopes of the American people, and does he have the skills to support the president, hopefully the next president? My view, I'm not going to pretend I don't support Kamala Harris 100%. So there's a little strategy involved. So what? Since when don't we do that?
Yeah. And I think part of what we're doing right now, or at least what the Democratic Party has to do, because for the Republicans it's virtually impossible, is branding. They are branding the team that's going to run together. Hmm. And just to call him governor, most of us are not all that impressed by governors, I think, but we're much more impressed by coaches, and coaches who have been successful and are warm and human and friendly and get the job done. You know, it's not necessarily about winning either. The other thing I keep thinking about is we have to keep reminding ourselves that the vice president is one heartbeat away from the presidency.
Yes.
And that is so critical. One of the other commentators said a lot of this appears to be about gender. You know, everything in 2024 in every issue in the United States has gender in it someplace. It has race in it someplace. It's just who we are as Americans. And owning up to that is much smarter than hiding or running away from it.
Yeah. Everyone can see who's at the top, right? I mean, it's easy. You look up and you see who's at the top. And when who's at the top doesn't represent
Amen.
Your neighborhood, when it doesn't represent the people you know, when there's lack of diversity. I mean, I know people – well, I'm not going to get into all of that because that's not what today is about. And I'm here to bring in opinion, not to give you my own. But however
– But we treasure your opinion, Eric.
Well, but I will say – but I just think it's obvious, right? If you look up and you see the people in charge – and they don't represent a cross-section of America, then something's wrong.
Right.
I mean, it's just
– absolutely
it just,
right.
That just –
You know,
and, pretty
and
clear.
The guy, Mr. Walz, Governor Walz, it wasn't just the football coach. He was also started the Gay Straight Alliance at his school while he was the football coach. So, you know, you can't reduce his resume just to this coach thing.
We have a couple of calls. Caleb is calling from Pittsford and Dan from Brighton. I'm going to get to your calls in just a moment. Before I do, I dangled this question out there, and I want to make sure we get to it. What is our reaction and what is the impact when a coach violates our trust?
Well, you know, I want to jump in on this because a player on a team or an individual training for a sport like gymnastics, this is not someone walking into a classroom. This is a person who's coming in with a dream and who is pursuing something of great, great value and importance to them. And so as a result, and leaning in so much to their dream of achievement or experience in a sport, that makes the player extremely vulnerable, extremely vulnerable. And so coaches have to have, just like teachers, doctors, anybody who's working with individuals, nurses, have to abide by the highest ethical standards.
Yes.
And any coach who exploits a child or abuses a child, you know, we should come down on that in every way we can, whether
Absolutely.
It be in a criminal proceeding, a civil proceeding, or just the opprobrium of our society, because that's unacceptable.
Right.
And, you know, the wax of the soul of a young athlete is particularly soft. And the impact of an adult who's cruel or abusive to that child is permanent. And we have to be on the lookout for that.
So well said.
Absolutely.
I learned so much. Two seasons I was the assistant football coach. I was a defensive backfield coach at St. John Fisher College. And I worked for a guy named Bob Bayer, and Bob was Mr. Integrity. He was so classy and so kind, and he acknowledged everyone's existence. And we were an awful team. It was our first 2 years of playing college. It was actually club football, but we played some Division III teams and really got our butts kicked. And Bob just – he did so much good for the benefit of each one of those students. But also, he made us feel good about the fact that we just participated. We might have gotten our butts kicked, but we did something really good and profound. And he used to say over and over again, he said, remember that you're representing St. John Fisher. And he said, you're representing an entire community. So be classy, be elegant. And he would never, ever tolerate any kind of violation of trust.
I'm so glad each of you shared that because it is so critical. I have found myself in various roles of mentoring, which we're calling coaching in some ways, and that is a sacred trust. It is a sacred trust because someone is trusting you and willing to receive what you're willing to pour into them. And if you pour the wrong things into them or if you satisfy your own desires in whatever way that is, whether it's ego or things worse— It is criminal at the highest level. So I'm glad we covered that, but I'm going to jump off of that right now. We have Caleb from Pittsford here on the line, and I'd like to welcome Caleb to the call. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me okay? I hung up. Are you there?
Yeah, you hung up, but you came back on. You were good. You got right back, so thank you.
Okay, awesome. Thanks so much. I'm glad you brought up Steve Kerr, because last night, when he said at the end of his speech, imagine if we, as 333 million Americans, could come together like 12 people who are all on different teams who used to compete to try to win. To me right there, that was the job of a coach and a politician, to be able to inspire. So right there in that moment where we've been told, and that's the truth, we are so against each other in this country, he just opened the door into a glimpse of hope. And to me, that was just so inspiring. I thought that was great as a coach.
So beautifully said. That's perfect.
So and as an American. So thank you.
Thank you, Caleb.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. It is true, right? I mean, when we're brought hope as opposed to division.
I've always wondered about, you know, what Steve Kerr did. But even, you know, teaching at St. John Fisher College, I've had a chance every once in a while to sit in my office and have a line of Buffalo Bills coaches. I could hear them in the rooms. And I have to tell you, this guy, the current coach, Sean McDermott, is one of the classiest, most elegant, caring, kind, and passionate coaches I've ever heard in my life. And I could tell you some of the previous coaches, at least since they've been coming to St. John Fisher, I think it's 2001 or 2002, some of them just didn't have that kind of, I don't know, I guess I'd call it passion and elegance, both. And Sean has that, and he has the respect of players. And by the way, I always wonder, how can you be a professional coach when somebody's making $40 million a year and, you know, the average pay on the team is probably $2.5 million a year? How can you be a coach? I don't know how you – but you know, you talk about people who have to win trust. Mm-hmm. You know, it has to be something really, really monstrous to be able to do that. But then I used to see my wife as a kindergarten teacher, and she was the ultimate coach. And I used to say, boy, if there's anybody who could freeze a classroom with a look, it was her. You know, she could freeze a group of 35-year-olds. She was the coach, too.
So Dan's here on line one. Dan, thank you for your patience. It's wonderful to have you join. Welcome to Connections.
Thank you for taking the call. I heard Tom Friday before talk about Genesee Valley Baseball, I think it was, and I have a long history there from many, many years ago. So I was wondering what he did and what years he was involved there.
Well, I was mostly an umpire, but I used to umpire with a guy who ended up making it to the major leagues, Kenny Kaiser. Kenny rubbed my nose in that for years. He used to say, see, one of us was really good and made it to the majors, and one of us was a pretty bad ump. And, you know, so I did a lot of umpiring at Genesee Valley Park. I also played one season of American Legion, and we played at several of our games at Genesee Valley Park. So it was always a fun place to be.
Which diamond at Genesee Valley, do you remember?
I also pitched a game there once against a guy who ended up pitching for the Chicago Cubs named Art Ceccarelli. And this was a Little League World Series playoff game to see who was going to be one of the first teams going to be going to Williamsport to actually try a Little League World Series. And he and I pitched a game that lasted 12 innings, which we found out later on made both teams irrelevant. But with the field we played on backed into the river, and I don't think that field is there anymore.
Oh, no, that's where the swimming pool is now.
Yes, where the swimming pool is now, right. So this is probably 1958. That's a long time. I'm 78 years old, so that'll give you an indication of when I was there. And I love my time with Kenny Kaiser. And by the way, Kenny Kaiser probably would have been the worst coach in the history of the world. But he was, you know, and I think there was something that made him a fantastic umpire that was probably just the opposite of coaching. And yeah, I'm going to have to think about that one. I'll probably have Kenny Kaiser dreams tonight.
I forgot about Kenny. Kenny played for one of my dad's semi-pro teams, but my dad was very involved with the Genesee Valley Little League, and my brother and I were forced to groom those fields day after day.
I love that.
That's a child labor violation.
Child labor violation. Here comes the legislator again.
So well, Dan.
Anyway.
Dan, what was your dad's name?
Walt Seeley.
Oh, I know Walt Seeley. Yeah, I knew him. Yeah, I umpired games with that he was involved in. Yeah. So,
well, Dan, thank you.
I guess I never had to throw him out.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dan, for joining the call today. We have a couple more comments online here. Charlie in Pittsford. This goes back to the Walt's coach piece. Charlie in Pittsford says qualified. Tim Walz is overqualified. He's the governor of a state. The fact that he was a teacher, a coach, a family man, and a soldier puts his qualifications beyond reproach. Harris and Walz are going to win and protect democracy. And then Chris in Geneva says, a coach can be an almost second parent for a kid. Unfortunately, the creeping professionalism of all levels have monetized athletics. Many coaches run their own club teams and encourage year-round specialization in one sport, arguing that it is needed to win a scholarship. Colleges play along using the scholarship term rather than marketing and admission, or using, the scholarship term rather than the marketing and admission efforts that they are. One sport year, let me make sure I get this right, one sport year-round athletics is damaging. Coaches charging parents is unethical.
You know that, what's that person's name?
This is Chris in Geneva.
Chris, thank you. One of the things that I was really proud of as a teacher was I taught Scott Fitch at Fairport, and he's now one of the preeminent coaches in the country. He's won 4 gold medals for USA basketball. He's coached 60 players who are in the NBA. He's cut a number of players who are in the NBA. And one of the reasons why he's coaching for USA basketball is they only allow coaches to coach in the USA basketball program for the U16 and the U17 and the U19 players who have never been part of monetizing their relationship student athletes. So they've avoided anybody who may have been seeking to be part of the entourage of an athlete or kind of peddling some idea about future riches for athletes. And so if we can look at a Scott Fitch and by the way, he and his father have coached Fairport for 56 consecutive years, father and son. We can see in him the kind of coach that we should be entrusting our athletes to because he never violates that ethical question of who he's there for.
Excellent.
By the way, I think Chris also brings up a point for another program someday, and that is the monetizing of sport and trying to convince young males and females that that someday they're going to make it. And when you realize the numbers are so far against you, and then this the whole concept of a single sport year-round activity, boy, it's so difficult. The first time I met Hank Aaron, I'll never forget. He was telling me and my brothers and my dad. Talking more to my dad at the time. I think I was about 10 years old. But he said, I think I'd probably be a much better baseball player if I didn't have to paint houses in the summer, in the wintertime.
Right.
And, all that changed, and I had a chance to meet him many years later. And I said, do you remember your comment about painting houses? And he said, yeah. And I just missed the Curt Flood decision. Otherwise, I would have made a lot more money than I did. So
I'm gonna go one more personal story here, and I don't think my son's ever gonna hear this program, so this is for him to hear this. But you know what? One of the coaches who impresses me the most is my son Phil. He took on a program that was losing, running in 12th place or below, and within a couple of years got them to first place. And he did it by upholding the highest values in the sport while making every kid feel valuable, while at the same time saying, guess what, you're not going to be on the A team because you're not working hard enough, you're going to be on the B team. But even the B team is winning when compared to, when playing against other B. And he would never let his people, his kids, root against other players. He said, your job, this is cheerleading, he says, your job is not to denigrate somebody else. It's to do your best and cheer them on because it's the sport that we care about.
Amen.
We want to make sure that we're doing the right thing. And I go and I look at him and I go, where did he come from?
You did a good job, Dad. He's replicating and he's modeling behavior. I'm gonna end my comments with one
last
thing.
Ahead.
I just think it's astonishing that Ted Lasso has become such an iconic figure of one of the best TV series ever done, and he's the coach. Hmm. And now here we are with Tim Walz doing, kind of filling the same kind of role. I hope there's something great that comes out of that.
For our viewers who haven't seen Ted Lasso,
what a show.
He doesn't know anything about the sport, and he knows everything about human beings.
Huh.
So he gets a job coaching at one of the highest levels in the world, and he doesn't even know what the rules are, but he knows the human heart, the human psyche, And that is the literacy of a great coach.
Hmm. I think that is probably where we're going to leave it.
Yeah. So beautifully said, John.
Yeah,
thanks.
So beautifully said. So thank you so much for our guest today, John Baines, who's the Monroe County legislator for District 11, a retired teacher who taught for over 40 years and serves on the legislature's Recreation and Education Committee, as well as on the Planning and Economic Development Committees as the ranking minority member. Thank you for your insights today. It's been great having you here.
Thank you. We actually won the majority, so
yeah,
I'm no
majority.
Longer
the
minority.
Oh, the majority layer. I love it. See, the internet is not the truth, the place of all truth.
Right on.
So, all right. And then Tom Priority. Tom is an old friend who's no stranger to connections at WXXI. He's WXXI's media reporter, and he's the resident media scholar at St. John Fisher. And I want to thank, of course, all the folks that have helped make it possible here today. This is Miles Young, who's our engineer. Thank you, Miles. Julie Williams, the associate producer. Megan Mack, our executive producer. Theme music is by Rah Rah Riot and Barsook Records. And thank you for making member-supported public radio possible. You do that with your membership. You do that by listening in, and you do that by supporting the programming that you care so much about. So thank you for being here today. We'll see you in a few more minutes on Connections.